the weapons of war to make sure that they can win these battles against basically what are minnow countries with very little self-defense capabilities.
Thank you very much for that. We're unfortunately out of time. Let me thank Farhi, journalist, author, and activist, and Judith Billow. Judith Billow, that website that you said, BanKillerDrones, that's what the name is, .org, is that accurate?
Yeah, I said BanKillerDrones.org.
Okay, very good. Judith Billow, peace and justice activist, and of course the website BanKillerDrones.org. You do want to check it out. Spoke to us from Rochester, New York. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Yikovet Ahway and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21 of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Young.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا لو هدانا الله سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank since Wednesday rises to 3. Iran slams mistreatment of an Iranian national by a Swedish court, saying it will spare no effort to protect its citizens anywhere in the world. And also in our headlines, Peru witnesses new clashes between police and demonstrators angry over the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Israeli brutalities against Palestinians show no sign of abating. The regime's forces have killed one more Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The victim has been identified as Samir Uni Harbi Aslan from the city of Al-Quds. The killing comes just a day after an Israeli settler fatally shot a 19-year-old Palestinian near the city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. That followed an alleged stabbing attack. On Wednesday, Israeli troops reportedly shot another young Palestinian man in the head during a raid on the Balata refugee camp. He later succumbed to his injury. Reacting to the fresh Israeli bloodshed, the resistance movement Hamas has said that the Palestinian people will continue to defend their land until it's liberated. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since early last year. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli raid of the Qalandia refugee camp in the occupied West Bank is yet another act of violence against Palestinians.
This time, Israeli forces have raided Qalandia refugee camp between Al-Quds and Ramallah to conduct arrests among Palestinians as usual. During this operation, Israeli forces raided the narrow streets of Qalandia refugee camp and arrested from Qalandia 12 Palestinians, including the son of this Palestinian martyr, 17-year-old Ramzi Aslan. The Israelis wanted to arrest him, and here his father tried to prevent the Israeli soldiers from brutally taking his son and from beating him. However, Israeli forces opened fire at the father, Samir Aslan, and they stripped him from his clothes and left him on the ground. He was bleeding. A number of soldiers were around him. And it was according to the footage that we have received, the Israeli soldiers were surrounding Aslan and left him bleeding until he succumbed to his injuries. Today, 18 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces. As I have mentioned, a dozen of them were arrested in the Qalandia refugee camp, and the remaining were arrested in the Dehesha refugee camp in Bethlehem. In addition to one Palestinian was detained by the Israeli forces during a raid to Qalqilia, northern the occupied West Bank.
Iran has strongly criticized mistreatment of one of its nationals by Swedish court, saying it will spare no effort to protect its citizens anywhere in the world. Iran's foreign ministry also reminded the Swedish government that they need to respect human legal and consular rights of the Iranian citizen jailed there. The ministry's statement referred to the plight of Hamid Nouri, an Iranian citizen imprisoned in Sweden over alleged rights abuses. He was arrested in 2019 on charges brought against him by the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group. Nouri attended his appeals court hearing on Wednesday, slamming his trial as unfair. He urged the judge not to hold a sham trial, saying that he wouldn't attend further hearings until his problems were addressed. In reaction, the judge ordered his microphone to be turned off. His family has told Press TV that Nouri has been humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services during his detention and trial period. Doctors and medical experts in Yemen believe that Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces are using biological weapons, which are believed to be the reason for the increased cancer and birth defect cases in Yemen. Yusuf Mowry has more on the story.
Sana is dying. She was born just a few days ago, but because of a rare birth malformation, doctors believe she only has a few days to live. Sana is one of the thousands of Yemeni babies facing a similar fate. Here in the Sab'een Hospital in the Yemeni capital, doctors say they have been receiving birth defect cases at an alarming rate since 2015. That's when the Saudi-led coalition launched its war on Yemen. Doctors here are convinced that biological weapons were employed by the Saudis.
We've received many birth defect cases throughout the years. However, this is the first time we received a case like this. She does not have the bottom limbs or kidneys or even a urinary tract or liver. She is missing all of her bottom half organs. Malformation cases have risen significantly since 2015. We believe the rise in these cases is due to the hazardous poisons from the weapons being used in the war.
Cancer cases are also on the rise. The spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health says that the data and statistics recorded since the war started indicate that biological weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition are the main cause of the steady increase in cancer and birth defects.
These cases are rising in the areas that were targeted by illegal weapons in a number of provinces in Yemen, which has led to a significant increase of various kinds of cancer cases and also birth defects and miscarriages. It was never like this prior to the war.
We visited the registration office at Yemen's only oncology center. It was packed with people pushing their way to register for cancer treatment.
I am here to register for medication. I have oral cancer.
I have just received another case. The person who just registered is from Eb and has liver cancer.
According to Yemen's Ministry of Health, the number of cancer patients increased by more than 50% since the war was launched in 2015. The Yemeni Ministry of Health says it will form a committee to officially investigate the main cause for the increase in birth defects and cancer cases in the areas that have been hit the most by the Saudi airstrikes. Even if it's evident that prohibited weapons were utilized by Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces, it is unlikely they will face prosecution, since most of the weapons used in the war are supplied by the American and British governments.
Doctors and medical experts say the increase in cancer and birth defect cases is rooted in the 8-year Saudi-led war that has polluted Yemen's air, water, and food. They blame the Saudi-led coalition's use of prohibited weapons such as biological weapons, toxic gases, and cluster bombs. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Asian stock markets push higher as China emerges from strict COVID restrictions and optimism for a pickup in demand grows. MSCI's broadest index of Asia-Pacific shares outside Japan rose 0.5% and touched an almost 7-month high. This comes as the fall in China's consumer inflation and a larger-than-expected drop in factory gate prices in December. Inflation in 2022 rose by an average of 2%, making China an outlier compared to with other major economies where prices soared on the back of a spike in energy and food costs and supply chain volatility. There's a hope that falling inflation will reduce the need for interest rate hikes. Elsewhere, UK Royal Prince Harry has caused anger and upset after revealing in his new book that he killed 25 Afghans during his military service in the formerly UK-occupied country. British Muslims are especially outraged, with many prominent community members now demanding he stand trial for war crimes. Robert Carter reports.
The UK's rogue royal, Prince Harry, has come under fire both at home and abroad after admitting he killed 25 Afghans during his military service. In his highly controversial memoir, Spare, Harry claims he killed 25 people during his 2 tours of occupied Afghanistan, adding he didn't think of them as people, but instead as chess pieces that had been taken off the board.
Harry served as an attack helicopter pilot between 2012 and 2013. The book alleges that all the targets were combatants. However, following furious protests from inside Afghanistan, many British establishment critics have condemned the revelation, believing that it creates a new and unnecessary security threat against his own family members.
Amid the condemnation, British Muslims feel particularly outraged. Afghans are also furious, with many, including Taliban officials, issuing demands for Harry to be put on trial for war crimes.
The consensus in Afghanistan, and amongst probably Muslim opinion all around the world, is that he was involved in a war where hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghans were killed, a nation was destroyed, millions were displaced, and therefore he is a war criminal who should be accounted for his crimes. I run a British Muslim website, and we did an online poll the other day, and it had about 5,000 votes. It was a one-day poll, and 85% of our readers said that Prince Harry was a war criminal. And that's because Muslims, you know, we consider ourselves one body, and if one part of the body hurts, the whole of the body hurts.
Many British Muslims are left questioning how they now view a royal family with Muslim blood on its hands. Robert Carter, London.
Well, Ukraine says it will be able to win the war with Russia in 2023 if it receives more Western weapons, particularly long-range missiles and heavy tanks. An advisor to Ukraine's president said only missiles with a range of over 100 kilometers will allow Kiev to take Ukrainian territories back from Russia. Mykhailo Podolyak added that if Ukraine's demands were not met, the war would go on for decades. The U.S. has already supplied Ukraine with missile systems with a range of around 80 kilometers. Kiev, however, is pressuring Washington to deliver missiles with a range of around 300 kilometers. They would allow Ukraine's forces to target Russian arms depots deep inside Ukrainian territory controlled by Moscow. Russia has warned time and again that continued supply of Western arms would only prolong the war and increase the suffering of Ukrainian people. And there's no end in sight to violence in Peru over the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. New clashes have erupted between police and Castillo's supporters who were trying to take over the airport in the southeastern city of Cusco. In some videos circulating online, demonstrators could be seen receiving assistance for their injuries. A prosecutor says the protesters were off to repeat what unfolded in the city of Juliaca, where 17 people were killed after demonstrators tried to take the city's airport
On Monday, Peru has been roiled by protests since last month after Castillo was removed from office and taken into custody. People are calling for his release as well as the resignation of new president Dina Boluarte. More than 40 Peruvians have been killed during the unrest so far. In Brazil, thousands of rioters have attacked government institutions in a dangerous echo of the United States' January 6th insurrection. Police are questioning some 1,000 protesters detained as call for justice and accountability grow across the South American nation.
Police in Brazil have detained some 1,500 supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro over attacks on government buildings at the weekend, as calls for justice and accountability grow across the South American nation. Most of the former far-right leader's backers were detained when law enforcement forces dismantled a protest camp in the capital, Brasilia, which many demonstrators set off from on Sunday before breaking into Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. The administration of Brazil's new left-wing president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was officially sworn in on January 1st, has pledged to investigate those behind the violence and hold them to account. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who is running investigations of the anti-democratic protests, vowed in a speech on Tuesday to combat what he called the terrorists at work in Brasilia. Rioters broke windows, toppled furniture, and hurled computers and printers to the ground as they ransacked the government buildings on Sunday. They destroyed precious works of art, overturned the U-shaped table where Supreme Court justices convene, ripped a door off one justice's office, and vandalized a statue outside the court. Lula denounced what he called far-right acts of terrorism as he met the leaders of both houses of Congress and the head of the Supreme Court. He had also blamed Bolsonaro for instigating his supporters after a campaign of baseless allegations about the October election results. Lula has vowed to bring to justice those responsible for what he called the fascist assault and declared federal intervention in public security in the capital lasting until January 31st. The riot came after Lula, who previously served as Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010, narrowly defeated Bolsonaro in a hard-fought presidential election runoff on October 30th. Bolsonaro is a former army captain who has expressed admiration for the military regime that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. For months, he had falsely claimed the country's electronic voting system was vulnerable to fraud. Sunday's riot in Brasilia also drew parallels to the January 6, 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, which saw a mob of former President Donald Trump's supporters storm the legislature in an effort to stop Congress from certifying his successor Joe Biden's election victory. Brazilian police were noticeably slow to react to the riot in Brasilia, even after the arrival of more than 100 buses, leading many to question whether authorities had either simply ignored numerous warnings, underestimated the protesters' strength, or been somehow complicit. Prosecutors in the capital said local security forces were negligent at the very least.
Rights advocacy groups have renewed their calls for the closure of the U.S.-run infamous Guantanamo Bay prison, which has a colossal legacy of abuse. On the 21st anniversary of the opening of the notorious facility, some 160 international rights groups have sent a joint letter to U.S. President Joe Biden urging him to shut it down. The facility is a symbol of Washington's so-called war on terror and is globally known for widespread violations of human rights there. Some detainees released from there, and even U.S. personnel had recounted harrowing stories of torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and forced feeding. One rights group has described the prison as a symbol of injustice and disregard for the rule of law. The prison has never been closed despite promises by respective American presidents. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The World Bank has predicted that the world's economy will face a sharp decline in 2023 due to soaring inflation and soaring interest rates. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. The World Bank slashed its 2023 growth forecast on Tuesday, 10th of December, to levels teetering on the brink of recession for many countries as the impact of central bank interest rate hikes intensifies. Russia's special operation in Ukraine continues, and the world's major economies' engines sputter. The development lender said it now expected global gross domestic product growth of 1.7% in 2023, the slowest pace outside the 2009 and 2020 recessions in nearly three decades. In its previous Global Economic Prospects report in June of 2022, the World Bank had forecast 2023 global growth at 3%. The bank said major slowdowns in advanced economies, including sharp cuts to its forecast to 0.5% for both the United States and the Eurozone, could foreshadow a new global recession less than 3 years after the last one. The World Bank said in a statement accompanying the report, given fragile economic conditions, any new adverse development, such as higher-than-expected inflation, abrupt rises in interest rates to contain it, a resurgence of the COVID-19 pandemic, or escalating geopolitical tensions could push the global economy into recession. The World Bank said the bleak outlook will be especially hard on emerging markets and developing economies as they struggle with heavy debt burdens, weak currencies and income growth, and slowing business investment that is now forecast at a 3.5% annual growth rate over the next 2 years, less than half the pace of the past two decades. World Bank President David Malpass said in a statement, weakness in growth and business investment will compound the already devastating reversals in education, health, poverty and infrastructure, and the increasing demands from climate change. The World Bank report said China's economic growth in 2022 slumped to 2.7%, its second slowest pace since the mid-1970s, after 2020, as zero-COVID restrictions, property market turmoil and drought hit consumption in China. Production and investments were also lower. It predicted a rebound to 4.3% for 2023, but that is 0.9 percentage point below the June forecast due to the severity of the COVID disruptions and weakening external demand. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. In its half-yearly health check, the Washington-based World Bank said it had cut its 2023 growth forecast from 2.9% to 1.7% after the risk it identified 6 months ago all materialized. The World Bank's Global Economic Prospects report said the tougher-than-anticipated anti-inflationary measures, persistently high energy prices and continued lockdowns in China had led to a much weaker outlook for this year than it had expected last summer. Almost every advanced nation and nearly 70% of emerging and developing nations have had their economic growth forecasts cut. The World Bank's mission is to reduce poverty, and its president, David Malpass, said the deterioration in the global economic outlook meant the crisis facing development was intensifying. David Malpass said, emerging and developing countries are facing a multi-year period of slow growth, driven by heavy debt burdens and weak investment, as global capital is absorbed by advanced economies faced with extremely high government debt levels and rising interest rates. The World Bank President David Malpass added, the deterioration is broad-based. In virtually all regions of the world, per capita income growth will be slower than it was during the decade before COVID-19. The setback to global prosperity will likely persist. The World Bank said growth in the more prosperous advanced economies is projected to slow from 2.5% in 2022 to just 0.5 percentage point in 2023, adding that in the past two decades, slowdowns on a similar scale had resulted in global recession. Excluding China, growth in emerging market and developing economies is expected to decelerate from 3.8% in 2022 to 2.7% in 2023. The World Bank said in sub-Saharan Africa, which accounts for about 60% of the world's extremely poor, growth in per capita income over 2023-2024 is expected to average just 1.2%, a rate that could cause poverty rates to rise, not fall. In fragile and conflict-affected countries, per capita incomes are expected to decline by 2024. World Bank President David Malpass said investment growth in emerging market and developing economies was predicted to be 3.5% a year between 2022 and 2024, half the average rate increase seen in the previous two decades. He added much-needed capital was being diverted to richer countries. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered the same story. The head of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, warned this year will be tougher than 2022 for most of the global economy as the United States, the European Union and China see slowing economic growth. The International Monetary Fund's managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, said 2023 will be a tough year, with one-third of the world's economies expected to be in recession. Georgieva said during the appearance of the CBS program Face the Nation, she said because the three big economies, the United States, the European Union and China, are all slowing down simultaneously. The remarks come after the International Monetary Fund back in October cut its growth forecast to 2.7%, down from 2.9% forecast in July, amid headwinds including the war in Ukraine and sharply rising interest rates. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said China, the world's second largest economy, is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in the past 40 years, as COVID-19 cases surge following the dismantling of its zero-COVID policy. Georgieva said she expected China's economic growth to improve towards the end of the year, but there are concerns about its longer-term trajectory. Meanwhile, economists said the lingering energy crisis is expected to cause further recession in the Eurozone this year. Economists said prices in the region will rise by an average of over 6%, and unemployment rate will increase from the current 6.5% to 7.1%, by the end of 2023. High inflation and energy shortages will lead to a further decline in production and worsen the situation in the labor market. Subsequently, by the end of the year, the Eurozone economy will shrink by 0.01%. Chiara Zangarelli, an economist at Morgan Stanley, said, "Gas markets in Europe remain a key risk. Additional supply disruptions or a particularly cold winter could lead to renewed tensions and prices rising again, forcing another round of adaptation and demand destruction."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Story of the Sky.
Part 2.
From 3,500 years before the birth of Jesus Christ until the late 20th century,
about 14,500 wars have broken out, and over 3 billion people have lost their lives due to wars. Only 300 years of history of mankind have actually passed in peace. This is what Conway Henderson says in his book. Ever since its emergence, the U.S. government has been a pioneer of wars all over the world by directly or indirectly waging wars in 37 countries. The current figures on the U.S. military conflicts after World War II show that Washington's so-called plans to expand liberty have sent 20 to 30 million people to their graves. This is why military experts believe that for every one person that's killed in any war, there are 10 more people injured. This means the U.S. has so far caused incidents similar to the 9/11 attacks 10,000 times in different parts of the world. Ain al-Assad is the largest U.S. military base in Iraq that was constructed in the early 1980s when Saddam Hussein was in power. During the first days after the missile attack, the Americans did not allow any media to enter Ain al-Assad. 3 days following the attack, filming was limited to areas chosen in advance with close-up shots. But the reality was something else.
The fire was just rolling over the bunkers, you know, like 70 feet in the air. You start heading down 135 meters, make it about a third of the way there. The big voice, we call it, clicks in, incoming, incoming, take cover, take cover, take cover. I've got another football field to run. I don't know when this next missile's going to hit.
Can you hear the incoming? You
know, like a freight train going by you. It's six people running for their lives to get to this next bunker. We get to the bunker and realize there's roughly 40 people trying to stuff themselves into this bunker that's made for about 10 folks. And I grab the guy in front of me. I'm just like, you got to get in the bunker, and just like shoved everybody in there.
In Iran's missile strike on January 8th, 2020, on Ain al-Assad base in Iraq's Al-Anbar province, the power of Iran-made ballistic missiles and the impossibility of tracking the missiles with advanced U.S. Patriot missile systems came to light for everyone.
It's like the sun rising instantaneous. That's how bright it was.
And I just remember a very heavy sinking feeling setting in. I was like, man, we are not going to come up with a bunker plan that's going to be adequate for the number of people that we're talking about.
Headaches every day, horrible tinnitus or ringing in the ears, PTSD, and I'll be willing to admit that. I still have nightmares.
I've never been on one like this where real missiles being fired at our forces and where I thought the risks were so high.
Maybe everyone was waiting for a swift reaction by the U.S. to Iran's attack, but their leaders, knowing better than anyone else what the consequences of the attack would be, and that was suicide. The Americans didn't know that the smoke that bellowed after the MQ-9 drone hit General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi's cars was moving from the Baghdad International Airport to Washington, and that smoke will eventually get into their own eyes. The exit was the toughest experience for the politicians at the White House. Even though the missile attack was Iran's first direct encounter with the U.S., it wasn't the first time the Yankees were receiving a slap in the face by the IRGC forces in the air and on the ground and couldn't do anything other than remaining silent. Maybe we'd better go through a part of the projects. The sky of a country that is 1,648,195 square kilometers vast was among the most insecure airspaces in the world, no thanks to the former regimes. Today, with domestic experts and Iranian armed forces, there is no room for even the most advanced military aircraft without Iran's permission. From downing the Beast of Kandahar, or RQ-170, decoding its data and building an indigenized and optimized model, to crushing the $200 million U.S. Global Hawk drone, or MQ-4C, which breached the airspace in the Persian Gulf, and the domestically produced Hordod 3 air defense system, or hacking American spy drones that were deployed in Syria to support Daesh militants.
The only thing I can actually come up with is that the hand of God protected us, because really, nobody should have lived through this.
Iranians weren't worried about a large-scale confrontation in case things would escalate, because targeting the Zionist regime and the U.S. interests and bases in the region were certainly on the agenda for the Iranian military commanders. And this is the bottom line that the Americans knew very well and abstained from showing in a reaction to Iran's attack to their capital in Iraq, namely Ain al-Assad base.
Well, words can't even describe the amount of energy that is released by these missiles. Knocked the wind out of me, followed by the most putrid tasting ammonia tasting dust that swept through the bunker, coated your teeth.
The first reaction to the move was approving a law in Iraq's parliament. Iraqi parliamentarians demanded terrorist U.S. forces leave their country. They even announced a schedule for the withdrawal. But this isn't the entire story and was not limited to the Iraqi people. Other countries also reacted to the presence of occupying U.S. forces. Afghanistan was one of them. In an unprecedented incident, the Taliban downed a U.S. helicopter and celebrated. So the real revenge would be to completely kick U.S. forces out of the region. Never know how strong you are unless being strong is your only option.
in the limelight.
Biden has maintained many of Trump's sanctions against Cuba. Cuba says Biden applies blockade even more aggressively than his predecessors. On November 3rd, for the 30th time, the United Nations General Assembly called for an end to the illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, the current U.S. government, the one of Joseph Biden, of all those that the Cuban Revolution has known, is the one that has most aggressively and effectively applied the economic blockade. Carlos Fernandez do Cossio, Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs of Cuba, declared in a speech on December 14th, adding, it is the one that punishes the most, the one that causes the most damage to the daily life of Cubans and the economy as a whole. Fernandez do Cossio cited the disruption of Cuba's fuel receipt by sea and the extraordinary flow of Cuban migrants as examples of the severe harms that Cubans have faced under the Biden administration's implementation of the blockade. In his address at a conversation series on Cuba in the Foreign Policy of the United States of America held on December 14th at the Higher Institute of the International Relations in Havana, Fernandez do Cossio took aim at the Biden administration's enforcement of the blockade against Cuba, stating, there can be no doubt that the economic blockade is the defining factor in the bilateral relations between the United States and Cuba. Biden pledged during his 2020 presidential campaign that he would try to reverse the failed Trump policies that inflicted harm on Cubans and their families. In 2021, he claimed, "We stand with the Cuban people." But Biden's actions belie his words. Fernandez do Cossio said that Biden has applied with absolute and surprising loyalty the policy of maximum economic pressure that was designed by his predecessor, Donald Trump. Trump imposed 243 onerous new sanctions known as unilateral coercive measures in international law on Cuba as part of his maximum pressure strategy. More than 60 years ago, following the triumph of the 1959 Cuban Revolution, the U.S. regime imposed an economic embargo on Cuba. The rationale for the embargo was detailed in a State Department memo that advocated the disenchantment and disaffection of the Cuban people through economic dissatisfaction and hardship so they would overthrow the Fidel Castro government. The memo recommended the denial of money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. The embargo is not a single law, but a complex patchwork of laws, presidential proclamations, and regulations that Fidel Castro once called a tangled ball of yarn. American University professor and Cuba scholar William M. Leo Grand wrote in the National Security Archive, it has evolved over the 60 years since President John F. Kennedy put it in place, loosening and tightening from one administration to the next, depending on the president's preference for using hard power or soft power in dealing with Cuba. Since the Cuban Revolution, the United States has waged an unceasing assault, both military and economic, against the Cuban people, organizing an invasion, assassinations, terrorist attacks against civilians, and systematic economic sabotage, Isaac Saini wrote at Resumen. The blockade has cost Cuba more than $130 billion in damage, according to the United Nations. Fernandez da Costa also mentioned the Biden administration's commitment in May to allow remittances to Cuba, but said that it still has not happened and there is no commitment to dismantle the measures announced by the Trump administration to disrupt the remittances. In addition, although the U.S. regime announced measures to boost internet penetration and interconnection in Cuba, the U.S. regime still prohibits access for Cubans to more than 200 private commercial websites, according to Fernandez da Costa. This includes sites for education, health, science, and technology, art, culture, and innovation. The U.S. regime, Fernandez da Costa stated, admits that it intends to promote the Cuban private sector, not to contribute to the development of the Cuban economy, not to improve the standard of the living of the population, not to help a majority sector of the population, but rather identifies it as an instrument of political subversion, a political weapon. Dozens of lawyers have signed an open letter to Biden stating there is no legal or moral justification for Cuba to remain on the state sponsors of terrorism list. They wrote, Biden has the power to remove Cuba from the list and reverse many Trump-era sanctions through executive action. However, Biden has chosen to defend Trump's aggressive policies. Trump also stiffened the economic and travel blockade and activated Title III of Helms-Burton Act, which was enacted to discourage foreign investments in Cuba. Trump's activation of Title III greenlighted the thousands of lawsuits that will discourage tourism and investment in Cuba. In one such lawsuit, U.S. District Judge Beth Bloom issued an order on December 30 against four Florida-based cruise shipping companies that sailed to Cuba, requiring them to pay more than $400 million in damages. Fernandez da Costa pointed out that Biden could have suspended Title III like Trump's predecessors. Activating Title III has had a deterrent impact on our development purpose of attracting foreign capital, he added. In addition, the Biden administration could have ceased the practice of pressuring governments in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to refuse medical cooperation provided by Cuba, Fernandez da Costa said, adding, this U.S. action, of course, is intended to prevent dozens of thousands of people from receiving medical services, which is what Cuban doctors provide. Biden could also have ended punitive measures, threats, and persecution against fuel exporting companies, shipping companies, port agencies, insurance and reinsurance agencies, all aimed at depriving Cuba of fuel supplies that our country requires to function, which has had an extremely severe impact on the economy and the lives of the Cuban people, according to Fernandez da Costa. The blockade, the vice minister said, has an impact on everything that includes electrical service, transportation, the availability of medicine and material for medical services, and the ability to obtain supplies for food production and building materials. The U.S. government cannot pretend to treat Cuba as if it were part of its territory, or treat Cuba as if it were a colonial dominion, or treat Cuba as if it were an adversary defeated in a war. We are none of the three, Fernandez da Costa declared. He cited Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's observation that the intention of the U.S. regime is to strangle the Cuban economy and thus try to provoke social collapse and a political crisis in Cuba. Although the U.S. regime has failed in that purpose, it has led to economic depression in Cuba and the extraordinary flow of Cuban migrants. The embargo's overt purpose is to strangle the Cuban economy to promote regime change, according to the Alliance for Cuba Engagement and Respect, ACERE. coalition of organizations working to end the Cuba blockade. The United States regime spends more than $25 million each year to fund regime change programs against Cuba. On November 3rd, for the 30th time, the United Nations General Assembly called for an end to the illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. The vote was 185 in favor, 2 opposed, the U.S. and the fabricated regime of Israel, and 2 abstentions, Brazil and Ukraine. The resolution affirmed the sovereign equality of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal affairs, and freedom of international trade and navigation, which are also enshrined in many international legal instruments.
Another assassination.
Well, we have breaking news coming out of Tehran that another university lecturer has been killed in Iran, this in northern Tehran, in a bomb explosion that has just taken place in the northern part of Tehran. We still do not have all the information. This has just happened. Again, an explosion in northern Tehran. One person killed. That one person is a university lecturer, and at least 2 other people wounded. And, of course, we'll be bringing you all the latest on that story as we get it in right here at Press.
A university professor or one of the influential managers of Iran's nuclear program. Another assassination. Victims were selected from among those who were involved in Iran's nuclear energy program.
My name is Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan. I'm 35, married, and have a 6-year-old boy. I was born in Hamadan, where I got my primary and secondary schooling. Being accepted in Sharif University of Technology in chemical engineering, I went to Tehran and remained there for the rest of my life. After university, I got married and took a full-time job in Natanz enrichment site. I would see my family in Tehran only on weekends. I wish I could stay to pick the fruits of my labor in Natanz. But by divine providence, I'll oversee the project from heaven. The future is bright, no doubt. And success comes with the ultimate sacrifice. It's a divine law.
Thank God, we won. We managed to produce the fuel for the Tehran Research Reactor. The reactor is running now. That's what our assassinated scientists determined to do. The centrifuges never decreased in number. They assassinated our scientists, they assassinated Ahmadi Roshan, but the centrifuges increased in number. 1 month after his assassination, we announced a 50% increase in the number of centrifuges. The Fordo facility became operational. They didn't want this to happen. They assassinated Ahmadi Roshan to throw a spanner in the works. But their scheme didn't work.
The assassinations were carried out with the main objective of halting or slowing down the progress of Iran's nuclear energy program. These actions, however, were considered as ineffective by many Western experts.